Welcome to The Being Leader. I'm Annabel Graham.
So welcome back to the podcast. And today I'm joined by Nick Howell, who's been a previous guest before, and we're going to explore changing the team. So welcome, Nick.
Good morning. Good to be back again.
Now, I'm conscious it's been a while since we were recording together, so some people may not have listened to that episode, may not know who you are. And I think it's always useful when we've got guests on to get a bit of placement. So can you give me just a bit of, give everyone listening just a little bit of a background about what you do and how sort of change fits into your world? And then we'll see where this conversation takes us.
Fantastic. So as you said, the name's Nick Howell. I run a company called Abintus. And my focus, or our focus, very much is around the coaching and the leadership space. So a lot of my work is around developing coaches, training coaches, qualifications, or just one-day workshops. I tutor coaches, I assess, I do IQA work, etc. But then I also look to bring that in terms of what it looks like in terms of leadership and using within leadership, supporting leadership programs, as well as coaching one-on-one, coaching teams, etc. So that's really the bulk of what I do in that respect. So I've been going for about 7 years now, and it's nice, obviously, a flavor of work. And you're right, change is something which kind of always comes up in teams, always comes up in coaching, whether that's personal change, team change, whatever. And it's interesting you're talking about it, because I think the rate of change is changing. And it's a topic which I'm not sure organizations yet are giving enough as much attention to as they should or could do in that respect. So, yes.
Yeah, and I think that's interesting, because obviously this series, we're continuing that theme around change, and we've looked at how it affects the organisation. Now it's how we affect teams. And obviously you and I work together sometimes with teams. And I think what you said about the pace is really important, because I noticed, especially over the last couple of years, whenever we're with a team, whether it, and mostly it's senior teams we're working with, so exco or senior leadership teams, it's like you're going in and just pressing the pause button. Because everyone's running so fast with what's going on in their business, they're not taking time to pause and think about it.
Absolutely. And I think if you look at it as well, the rate of change of society, you know, businesses reflect that and what's happening out there. And I think as well, you know, if you look at COVID, you know, whatever people think about COVID, COVID accelerated the pace of change in some areas. So whilst change, you know, has, you know, sort of spectrum, good, bad, and different in many respects, we also have to recognise that, you know, when opportunities come along, we should be jumping on the change bandwagon in many respects and utilise that for ourselves.
Yeah. And I suppose in some ways it's recognising that no matter what we're doing in a business, we've always got this constant bubble of change going on. So whether we think about it from the team lens, it could be we've got a new leader, it could be we've got someone who's resigned, it could be we've got a restructure going on. You know, they're not necessarily formal change programs, but they're things that affect how the team works and operates. And often we view them as static, and they're not always.
Absolutely. And I think linked to that as well is, I often hear it when organizations or people talk about change, they talk about it in isolation. And they very much kind of, well, we've got some change, whether that's kind of localized team change and organization, let's set up a project team or a group to actually look at this, which is fine. But it becomes very then blinkered or tunnel vision, if you like, rather than actually viewing change as a very much a holistic and systemic activity. Nobody works in isolation. Everybody, whatever you're doing, depends upon other people, other processes, other bits of information, other parts of the organization. So when change happens, there is a huge, huge knock-on effect. And I'm so blinkered to become task focused, get the change done.
Yeah. And it seems as a linear thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've gone on the internet, and there's lots of 10 ways to approach change, etc. You know, and I guess kind of five or whatever, the best top tips for change. And, you know, I think there's just some principles. And one of them is actually when change is happening, whether it's for you, the team, or whoever, is actually just rather than diving in, is simply taking that step back. And rather than seeing a handful of trees in front of you, getting in your organizational helicopter and seeing the whole damn forest, and what does that tell you about the change and where it's going to impact, et cetera? And if we did that, I think we'd start to view change very, very differently.
Yeah, I'm smiling as you're saying about steps. is this where I admit I'm not a fan of Cotter's Eight Steps of Change, because I think it's not, it's just, I mean, it's a great book. It's out there. It's on the bookshelf. But I think it's too simplistic, and the world we work in is a little bit more complex, which sort of brings us back to teams, because teams are complex. So I think before we get started and thinking about different things that impact teams from a change perspective, I'd be really interested to know what are we deeming a team to be? And I say that because I think organizationally, we're really good in businesses about creating teams. So whether that's a hierarchical team where we just shove a load of people together and work on the theory that they're going to get on amazingly well, it's going to be brilliant, and they're naturally going to be perform. Or whether it's a project team who often have a massive remit or a big ask, and again, have never worked together. Or whether, you know, it's just a collection of people who in theory are called a team when they're not. So what do you view a team as?
It's interesting that last little point there, in terms of actually, we use the word team quite indiscriminately in organizations. Well, we've got a group, we've got this, but let's call it forming a team, etc. But actually, if you start to look at it, and it's have to be a complex, I just like to keep it very, very simple. And my view of it, you know, a group is those people who are kind of working together, but they've got their own particular agendas, goals, objectives, if you like. So the focus is upon themselves rather than actually a more corporate body. So when you look at teams, then again, a very simplistic approach, you know, it's those people working together. They've got a complementary set of skills. They've been brought together deliberately to fulfill a purpose. And they're working towards more of a common goal. It's very much them. How do we do this? How do we achieve this? Using our skills, knowledge, behaviors, experiences, etc., to achieve this for our team and ultimately for the organization in that respect. And I think it's really important here is recognizing that you can call something a team, but it doesn't make it a team. And team, the creation of teams. When I first started thinking about yourself, Annabelle, when I first in this business, the concept of a high-performing team was something we'd aspire to in the next 12, 18 months, etc. Now there's almost an expectation we have a high-performing team from the get-go, which is fine. We can have that, but it ain't going to just happen. It needs time, effort, energy, investment. You and I both work with senior teams, and we work together with some senior teams. And those senior teams have the most opportunity to change things, to become a team. They have the authority, the investment, the time, but it takes a long time. We're still working with teams 12, 18 months on, and actually they're only starting to get their heads around it and see what it is to be a team. So whilst we can call them teams, there shouldn't be an expectation that they are a team.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And, you know, as you said, there's this piece around common goal. So have we got this common goal and purpose which we all are going towards? And that's a crucial aspect. And the other part, and I know this ends up coming from, this is from a quote by Katzenbach and Smith.
Yes, yes.
They're also a group of people who hold themselves mutually accountable for that goal. So there is a degree of accountability for delivering it, and they've got a common way of working. So when we're coming out to this team piece, and I think this is the real interesting piece when you're pulling, I'm going to call them a hierarchical team because it could be at any level of a hierarchy, rather than just, you know, a senior level. It doesn't matter where it sits. But if you're in an organization and you have a team within a function or a department, then actually, you know, as you said, does everyone know what the common goal is? Are they all aware of what they're there to do? Have they agreed how they're going to work together, more to the point? What's okay and what's not okay? And that's from a behavior process and ways of working. You know, if they agreed how they make decisions and how often they're going to meet about what, when. And this sort of stuff seems to, people assume it happens like osmosis, but teams are living, breathing relationships. You know, they're like marriages. If you don't tend them, they fall apart, get a bit stale, and people get pissed off with each other.
Yeah, a marriage or even just an organism, if you like, for that organism to exist, everything needs to work together at the same time in the same way to get that outcome, if you like. And we forget about that. And there's so many, I use the word systemic, there's, you know, you really have those people together. I often imagine a circle, and within that circle, there's lots of other circles. And there's so many lines between all those circles, if you like, joined up. When that happens in that system, that's when we have a team. those interdependencies are working and flowing, not where there's flux.
Yeah. So let's have a little think about, you know, how change impacts teams. And because I think there's different levels of change. I mean, one of the most obvious ones is just change of people, whether that be team members or leaders. So what do you see happening when that?
I think we can look at leaders, look at members, if you like, and just looking at members first. I think teams are often very adaptable. So, you know, if we look, and it depends on that person's role, people's role in that team who are actually leaving. It's a highly critical role and obviously have a greater impact upon the system, the processes, the ways of working and the behaviours, etc. If it's less critical, obviously less of an impact. You know, obviously there's always a sense of loss. You know, you have to look at Tuckman to kind of look at his model. And he has that mourning stage, if you like. You know, but it's accepted. And I think in this day and age, increased acceptance that people move on. 20, 30 years ago, it's more of a job for life. So there's an acceptance that people move on. And therefore, I think teams can be very, very adaptable. It also depends if the person's liked, or the people are liked or not liked in that respect. And when those people go, roles, responsibilities shift, both in terms of the roles that they're actually employed to do, but also you look at Belbin, those secondary team roles, they shift as well in that respect. And being part of a team is also having membership. So when that membership changes, that internal dynamic also changes. You know, people can be very good at filling the gaps when people leave, but also, you know, the interactions, the patterns of working, the interpersonal relationships all shift when people leave. You know, it disrupts the internal processes that those teams have created for themselves in that way. So when people leave, there can be this immediate flux in those processes, coordination and task work. And it also therefore culminates in limiting the effectiveness and limiting the performance of the team, potentially to varying degrees, depending on the nature of those people losing it. So, yeah, so lots of things are happening at that level.
Yeah. And I think it's interesting, you said sometimes it can have an impact and sometimes it can't. And I think it depends on the individual, how many people leave in the team size for me.
Yep.
So if the team's very small, so say the team's only 3 or 4 people and we lose one key person, that's going to have quite a dramatic impact. If the team's 10 or 11, it's going to have less of a shift. So I think when I'm with organisations, I normally say, you know, if you've got more than a 50% constituent change, in the number of your members, you're going to see a dramatic change there, you know, depending on what the team size is.
I'd perhaps even argue it's actually in this day and age when there's greater skill sets and more specialised skill sets requires, actually, you know, it might be more 20, 30% in that respect.
Yeah, absolutely. It could be, depending on how different the skill sets of the teams
are. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. And the bit about liking, you're right. I've seen teams where they love the person and there's been that really deep mourning. And you talked about membership. People are constantly talking about them when they've gone and they're literally remembering them into the team. You know, if we think about what that word means, they're bringing them back in by keeping their stories alive, which is lovely, but difficult because it means they don't move on. But equally, I've also seen it. And they couldn't stand them. and the performance went through the roof because everyone went, brilliant, they've gone, and just pulled together. And the team actually got a whole energy from it. So it's really interesting about whether or not they like someone.
It is. And building on your first point there, when people leave and they're really liked, and you say people do remember it, but also that has a huge impact upon the person or the person's replacing them. So there's always that comparison. Well, so-and-so did this, so-and-so were like this, etc. And that's an affair. And that creates a bit of a legacy, which, again, can still affect the team dynamics a little bit. So there's almost a need to kind of go back to basics again. It's establish ourselves as a new, in many respects, a new team, to have new thinking, utilise that person's new skills that were different to the person who left in that way. So I think we need to really bear that in mind, because it's a huge legacy, which can have a long-lasting effect upon teams.
Yeah, it can have a long tail. And I think, you know, it's a really valid point. And that piece, as is that piece about reforming.
Yes.
We often, when key people leave, we don't go back and check in. Has everything we've agreed before, is it still okay? You know, are the ways of working still working? Do we still want all those routines we have? Do we need to rechange what we're doing? And more to the point, do the new people coming in know all of that stuff? Yes. Have we told them? So there's often this need to reform the team, and that it doesn't always happen.
No.
Which I think can be a bit dangerous.
Yeah, I agree very much. And it also kind of, we're talking about change today and changing teams, and that's absolutely right. But something I want to kind of raise, and I think you and I have spoken about this before, and a lot of the research and reading I do around this, it doesn't get the gravitas or the position I think it should do. Because we're talking about change, but change is a physical, it's a transactional thing. And there's another side of it, and change actually is transition. And transition is about psychologically moving people through the changes happening, letting go of where they're at, start to think about new things and embracing new ways of doing approaches. So when you bring new people into a team, there has to be for both parties this transition phase, an enabler, and almost forcing that to happen. This is where this reforming comes in that you were talking about here. And a lot of the reason why change fails, in my view and reading, is because too much emphasis is put on the change. Change might be writing a new process, bringing in some new software, setting up a new team, a restructuring. That's a change. But how you actually get people to embrace and walk through that, that is critical. And we don't do it very well as organizations.
Yes.
It's not seen as valuable. But from the moment you start a piece of change, the people element should equally be thought about.
Yeah. And I think that becomes even more crucial when you talk about that transition piece when we've got reorganizations happening.
Absolutely.
So if you've got a restructure of the team or we've recut it, that becomes that key bit where people actually, you get a bit of survivor's guilt, where people feel guilty because they were still there and that some of their members left and they still got a job. And we also get this lethargy where people get stuck, you know, especially if they didn't agree with that reorganization. And I've seen this happen really badly where, you know, a year later, people are still holding that anger because they've seen the job as their identity. And therefore, we end up with, they get stuck in that identity and there's a real challenge around it. But equally, if there's a long restructure, I remember being in a business where it was a 45-day reorg because obviously there was hundreds of people going at that point. And people were just fed up, you know.
Yeah.
They sort of got their heads around it the first couple of weeks of consultation, but then were made to work their noses rather than leaving. And it was just painful. And you could see there was this friction between the people who were going and the people who were staying. So that piece, as you said, about making sure we deal, you know, reorganizations are never nice. And quite frankly, you never want to initiate more than one in your career because obviously you just a masochist if you do, but there's often a reason for it. But you the best thing you want from it is for people to feel they've been treated fairly and left well, and that doesn't always happen.
Yes, and if you think about organizational change, and I've got no evidence for this, but this is my experience, when organizational change happens, what's the first thing that happens? It's not about actually what people think about the change, it's actually how it's going to affect me. How it's going to personally affect me financially, structurally, work-wise, et cetera, et cetera. So you go back to the classic Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Their security is potentially under threat. And so in any organizational change and team change for that matter, one of the leader's key roles is about coming to where each of those individuals are in the team. So actually, what's going on for you? Now, how do I start to work with you, talk to you, work you through this, if you like? So we can get them to the same page. Yes, there's lots of other factors on, absolutely. But that's a key one, is we need to help people to work through, whether that affects them positively or affects them negatively. A manager I knew, he worked up in Scotland on a big organization, and his team were going through a massive organization. And he'd say, look, guys, I don't care what you have to do to get through this change for yourself, but do it. Just to let you know, I set up a tab at a well-known high street coffee shop and said, go there by yourself, go there with a team, go there with pairs, and just discuss this for yourselves, you know, and I'll cover the cost of it. But just doing that simple gesture, enabled people to work through that change for themselves and their own pace, not forced to do it, but actually can have those open, honest discussions. which in a formal team environment we may not necessarily be prepared to have.
Yeah, I think that's a lovely way of just going, it's all right to talk about this. Because people, you're right, people react in very, very different ways. You know, I remember being, I've been made redundant 3 times, but I remember the last time, and it's an occupational hazard, ex-retailer, you know, that's what happens. But I remember the last time, I think I was, there was 3 of us in it. We were at quite a senior level and it was going, we were going from 3 roles to 1 role. And I remember the conversation being had with me and I went, I actually think it's 6 months overdue. I think we should have done it ages ago. So I moved really, really quickly through that curve of acceptance. Also, I'd been looking to move on. I needed something different. So for me, it was an amazing opportunity. I, in the end, didn't apply for anything, took voluntary redundancy and was over the moon. And people couldn't believe I was leaving because I left in about 4 days. I was looking after IT and HR, their dangerous departments. So, you know, it was faster for me to go, which was lovely. I got, you know, 3 months paid leave and bought cakes the day I left. And people thought I was mad. Absolutely mad. They went, aren't you supposed to be upset? I went, no, it's such a great opportunity. Mm. I think the person who ended up getting the role was initially a bit surprised, but then was really committed and stayed. And the third person got really stuck because they didn't get it. And it wasn't, you know, that's just 3 people and 3 very, very different reactions.
Yeah. You mentioned the curve there, you know, when we ever do training, you know, we always reel out the kind of the Kubler Ross grief curve or came from the change curve in that respect. And it's true, it's valid, it has a place. And whenever you kind of you train it with people, oh yeah, I get it. Oh yeah, I see myself going through this, or my team have been through this, yes. But how much they actually then take that, lift it and use it on an individual basis, recognizing your team, you've just shared there, you went through that process really, really quickly. Other people, it's a real, real slow uphill struggle. So, you know, people, line managers will talk about it, great model, but I don't know how much attention they actually give to their thinking and their planning around this change and this transition for themselves and for their team, as well as recognizing they're going through that as well for themselves in that way. So whatever model you're using, it's recognizing people need to be taken through it. And you and I are both advocates of coaching, and this is where coaching is such a fantastic tool to work with individuals and teams through this change process, through this transition. Tailoring to exactly what they need at that moment in time for themselves.
And I think also a lot of it's about personal agency. How much control do you feel you have over the situation? So you find the people who see things as, you know, who can see as a way of being able to take control often move through that a lot faster. Whereas if we're feeling it's done too and we have no control, that becomes even more destabilizing.
Yes. And I think that's another point, and when it comes to change and transition, line managers don't think about is what control, what things in this change process can I give to people? Because if I involve people, if I engage people in the process, whether they fully agree with the change or not, they're potentially more likely to buy into it, see the value in it because they're involved in it. And that's what I think, for me, that's one of the key factors. If wherever you can, involve as many of your people in that change, because it'll pay you dividends, it'll pay them dividends, and ultimately performance will be maintained as much as it can be through that change and transitional process. Yeah.
I think that's a really valid point. I remember in my previous world, I ended up leading on 2 or 3 systems changes. Again, never do more than one in your life. It's far too difficult. but I think what I learned from the early ones, and I remember doing with the last one, was I involved an awful lot of people. I mean, it was in retail, so I got a lot of the store managers involved. And I remember when we started it, being told, they're going to hate it. You know, there's this person in this branch and this person in this branch. They're going to be the biggest challenges you're going to have. And I went, why? And they went, well, they know it really well and they're really bought into it. I went, all right, then fair enough. So I just pulled them onto the change team and went, well, let's use you. Let's use you as advocates. And actually they were, you know, we got, I think, 3 or 4 people who ended up being the proofers, they wrote the guides, and actually involving people, they were the best advocates we could find. They were superb because they had the gravitas that people listened to them.
Yes.
So actually it meant they became the change agents. And it, you know, it could have been painful and I could have had a fight in my hands. But actually, having done that in previous worlds, I thought, no, there's a better way of doing this. And they were great. Superstars.
I think that is so much easier when the change is internal, led by the organization because of choices the organization's making. It's a little bit more difficult, but not impossible when the change is external. So exactly, maybe there's a quick regulatory change or whatever else. So the change is kind of imposed a little bit. So we just have to get it done to comply with it. So it's not saying it can't happen, but it's a little bit more difficult in that respect. And perhaps that's something you tend to join your specialists a little bit more rather than using the team universally.
Yeah. So we've talked a lot about how this affects team members. What about that change in team leader? Is there a difference from that piece, or what do you see?
I think there is a difference. And if you're just talking about the impact upon the team, you know, again, hopefully the leader's liked and wanted, etc. They've been doing a good job. So when that happens, yes, it's a significant loss. That figurehead, that leader, that organizer, that empowerer, whatever you want to call them, leaves. So the team can feel a little bit directionless, rudderless in many respects. Hopefully, if they've done a good job, you know, the team knows everyone's responses, so they can carry on that respect. And I think also it's dependent on the approach taken of the person who then comes into that team. Whether they are kind of just come in and it's kind of new person, new room mindset, or whether they take their time to observe, listen, experience, and then make some changes. So I've just, you and I know David Marcaney's his intent video. I've just listened to his podcast, his book on Audible, and it was fascinating because he was taking over leadership of a submarine. It didn't just happen overnight. He had this warming period. So he literally spent time in every department with every person in that team to understand what they did, how they did it, what they liked, what they didn't like, etc., and absorb this. So when he did start to take over the captain's role of that submarine, he made very, very much informed decisions based on what he thought was right and what was in the rules, but also what he felt the team needed to have happen. For them to engage in it, for them to perform, and for them, he uses this phrase, I changed the mindset from leader follower to leader leader. And any leader coming to a role has the opportunity to do that. But it's how they approach it that's going to be the real deciding factor in it. And David Marcaney's book, The Turn the Ship Around, is a great example of how to do that.
Yeah. And that time to just understand what's going on at a much lower level. Because often when we get to that to a more senior level, we are detached. There's a degree of detachment depending on how many levels of hierarchy sit underneath.
Yes.
And that can mean, you know, we don't always make the right decisions because we're not getting the right information. We're not going out and getting the right source information from a wide enough set of sources.
Absolutely. So one of my friends, she's a senior manager / leader in the NHS. And some of their senior roles, they change every 2 years. You know, people move on, etc. So when that next person comes in, they don't take that approach, which you've just suggested. Actually, well, they just change everything. So it has a huge impact, not just upon the teams, but upon the organisation. So you do get resistance. You do get change from the, oh, we've been here before, etc. So it's really, really frustrating for all parties. And those new leaders and managers wonder why. And there's a bit of antagonism between, you know, those people on the shop floor and those people, you know, in the hierarchy.
Yeah. But if we go back to that piece we said that you were talking about at the beginning about this need to get to that high-performing team piece, then actually that change of leader has a real impact, because what you've got is a team that had a set of processes and a common understanding about what they were going to do, and now we've got somebody else who's coming in. And very often has a different view of the world or has a different mandate, you know, especially to senior level.
It's almost guaranteed. Yeah. The exception rather than normal, which is the opposite.
Exactly. You know, there's normally a reason why, unless someone's been promoted from within the team, and that's slightly different. You know, we've got a different dynamic that we need to play with if they've been internally promoted, because all of a sudden I'm not a peer anymore. I'm now the leader. So that's a whole different dynamic to navigate. But someone coming in, what I see again and again not happening is that people don't create the team. they don't get them together. We don't sort of, you know, if you were having a project team, and this is fairly normal in the project world, if we have a project team, we get lots of people together who don't necessarily know each other very well. You've got a project manager who's leading it. You have a project kickoff. Everyone understands. We talk about who's doing what, how we're going to communicate and what we do. That's fairly normal. But hierarchical teams don't do that. They assume it's going to happen by osmosis and wonder 9 months in when everyone's bitching about each other and there's a whole load of storming going on because nobody likes each other and they're not really getting on and they're sort of not as effectual as they should be. Why? And it's because they've not done that.
Yeah, so they don't recognise there is a natural flow to a team's growth in that respect. And a little bit like coaching, you can't necessarily jump around the process so much. And the same here, you can't go from just having your project team and expecting it to be high performing overnight because there are so many hundreds of different variables going on that need to be attended to, nurtured, created, co-created, enabled, allowed to happen, if you like, for them, the team to establish themselves, find themselves, learn those respective behavioral personality dynamics, etc., how to get the best from each other. You know, all the personality profiles that we've done, etc., that talk about people's different preferences and start to understand that, to be able to tap into that and utilize it. And only when those things start to happen do we say, oh yeah, so we are a team, we are doing this. How do we further this to actually become this high performing team? But there needs to be that internal focus, that internal, hold the mirror up to the team a little bit, say, okay, where are we at? How do we get to the next stage? What's the next stage look like? So a lot of teams, you know, as we both know, they consider themselves high performing, but actually when you start to peel away the layers, they're not. They're just established themselves. They've got some norms in place, absolutely, but that's not high performing. That's not self-managing, self-leading in that respect.
Yes, and there's that piece about having to be very purposeful about it. And I think, you know, for anyone who's listening, if they're leading a team and they haven't done this, it's absolutely crucial to go back and do it. And it doesn't matter when. Leading teams for 20 years, 8 of those every year, I seem to get a different region. I wasn't incompetent. The business was growing. I'll just put that out there now. But actually, that involved having to recreate and redo that all the time. So way before I got into the learning world, actually, that was just what we did. You had to get them together. You had to talk to them about what the strategy was, what the direction was, how we were all going to work, what was okay and what wasn't okay, and get people together to know, because often that new region, they hadn't all worked together before, so they didn't all know each other. I remember one year doing a regional meeting, and there was 30 branches, and they had been formed out of 2 different areas. And it was hilarious. We had a U-shape in the room, and this region geographically ran from Reading to Thurrock in Kent. So it was basically the whole top of the M4 along the top of the M25. It took about 3.5 hours to drive from one end to the other if I was trying to do the stores in the same day. But everyone in the west sat at one side of the room and everyone in the east sat at the other side of the room because they were the people they knew. And nobody talked across the divide. And I remember looking at this going, how am I going to make this lot work together? And I had to put somebody from each side together on a project, and that was the catalyst. They got the link. But every time we did those meetings, we recreated it. Mm. You know, so if you think about what we do when we go in with a team, I mean, admittedly, we don't do it without finding out what's going on. So we'll do lots of one-to-ones before we do team coaching work to understand what's going on in the team. So it's a bit like you were saying about David Marquette going and finding out what's happening. We do a bit of a deep dive. But actually, we make them go back and set those conditions up. So agreeing what their purpose is, what their ways of working are, sharing stuff about each other so they get to know each other as people, not just the role. And starting to think about how do they actually work together? What's okay? What's not okay? Because they're the sort of bedrocks and basis that often they've never, ever agreed.
Yes. And, you know, you talked about, yes, you can get a group of people together as a team, if you like. And yes, you can talk about strategy and I can read about strategy. So that's fairly, and all those things, and those processes, it's all kind of, that's kind of on the surface. And then it's kind of getting to know each other. But what we have to recognize as well, and people forget about it, they didn't see it through this lens, is that actually a team changes because there are behavioural and mindset shifts in individuals and those corporate body of individuals. And mindset shifts and behavioral shifts, they take time. They need to be reinforced and supported and enabled when the wrong behaviors and mindsets are shown. It's kind of there clamped down a little bit. So, but it is this mindset and behavioral shift that has to occur, going from whether we're a team and we're now amalgamating with another team, or whether we're new teams come together, or having to accept 40% new people or change of leader. It's mindset and behavioral changes which underpin all of this.
Yes. And also recognizing that these aren't nice to haves.
No.
I think that's the thing. I do remember, I can't remember whether it was on a leadership program or whether it was with a team or an individual, but I do remember saying a few months ago, you do realize I'm not saying this because it's just a bit of theory and it sounds nice. You do realize you should be doing this. It's part of your day job. This is not a nice to have. If you want your team to function, these are just things you should be doing.
Yes.
Because if that's role modeled really well in the organization, it'll be happening by osmosis and you won't even realize. You'll have just learned it. I didn't go on a program to learn it. It was just what I'd been role modeled. So that's what you did. Yes. But actually, if it isn't role models, it's thinking about what do I need to be doing differently. So that that creation is so important. But I'm also thinking back to, we've talked a little bit about people leaving organizations and coming in and out, and when the leader leaves, you know, are they liked, they're not liked. And actually, what I was also thinking about is whether they leave well.
Yes.
So whether they've left by their own choice, resignation, you know, voluntary redundancy, or whether they've been removed. Because that actually puts a whole different dynamic on it when they go quickly, for whatever reason. And we usually see this more at a senior level than a junior level.
Yeah, true.
That has a whole ripple effect through a business. So what have you had experience of that, and what have you seen with that?
So I can think of one example when a senior manager was literally removed overnight for whatever reason. And it was fascinating because the rumour mill was just rife, absolutely. And all the different rumours, I thought, you haven't got a Scooby-Doo of an idea what's going on. But because I was involved in HR and development, we kind of got the lowdown a little bit. But it's a huge impact, you know. There's a kind of, it's not as though people have a time to accept and embrace this person leaving, if you like. They've just gone. They've been ripped out, torn out from the organization, torn out from that team, especially if it's the senior leader. And there's a void created. You know, it's how that void is kind of managed that leaves, you know, is it a patch fix? Is it a bit more of a long-term thing? You know, does the organization recognize it or just expect people to get on with it? It has a huge impact upon individuals, the team, and you know, and the organization to hold that way, as I say, especially if it's the senior manager in that respect. So it has to be handled very carefully. I think sometimes organizations need to be very, very brutally honest, you know, with a bit of a kid glove at the same time, but actually recognize what's happened, call out, because if they try to brush under the carpets, you know, the rumor mill will continue. Actually, let's just deal with it. We've dealt with the problem. So let's have some strong communications about it, what we're doing, what's happening from here, so we can start to actually not look back, but actually maintain that, or start that look forward, if you like.
And that so rarely happens, because often there's been a process that's bound in confidentiality.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's never acknowledged. You know, that person is just not there. And, you know, those who have been around organisations a while and been in a business a while are maybe a little bit more resilient to that because they've seen it before. But where you've got more junior team members who may not be, there's this, you said it's bereft, and it leaves a really long tail. It leaves a long tail for the people who are remain. But equally, it leaves such a challenge for the person who fills that void. Because A, there might be resistance because you're not who I had before.
Yeah.
And that wasn't dealt with well. There's then an even bigger challenge with them coming in if they want to do something differently, because the team who's left behind often hasn't accepted that thing has happened or that there was anything wrong. Therefore, the resistance of change, if they're changing ways of working, there's a huge pushback because the team feels they're not being respected. And there's this something called an ejector seat syndrome.
Yes.
Very often when somebody comes into a role, and I've seen this happen, and I've actually been in the ejector seat, I've been the one who came in, they don't last very long because they don't, they're not able to settle in the system because the system's got this rupture in there because this person, as you said, was ripped out. And the person who comes into it can't establish their authority. Therefore, what you find is they very often leave after 6 or 12 months and they've not had the impact that people bringing them in thought they'd have because actually they've not been enabled to have that impact.
I think partly they have been enabled, but actually what is it they've not done with that team? So let's say someone leaves, whatever reason, it's an overnight leaving. Someone's brought in there, whether it's an internal, whether it's an external, they have the opportunity to sit down with a team and actually call out, okay, we're not going to get into the whys and wherefores and the detail, but let's just call out what's happened. Something's happened, okay? Where are you at with this? How are you thinking? How are you feeling about this? What's important to you about this? How do we as a team start to accept and embrace this and start to move forward? And I think it's important at this stage, and I think it's a key part of any change, is how do I involve the team? How do I allow the team to use their creativity, their knowledge and their skills and abilities to actually start to shape that future? You know, then we've got a fighting chance of that person not being out ejected role in 6 to 12 months time, etc. Because they come up their own ways forward in that. And they can only do that if they themselves go through this grieving process or whatever else. But if it's not allowed to happen, yes, there will be that resistance. There will be resentment, etc. in that way. I think all these things can be overcome if the leader and manager go with it in the right mindset and the right attitude to it, rather than actually, let's ignore it, let's carry on. That's not going to happen.
I think you're right there, but I think there's a key thing you said. If they're made aware.
True.
Because often they're not.
Yes.
And I think this is, and I've seen this, especially where there's been a gap between people taking over, that often you'll get a repetitive ejector seat. And no one can settle in that role. And this is often when you look at an organization, you see there's been five people or three people in 5 years in the same job role. There's something going on there that says, you know, this person isn't settling. Whereas when you were saying about that, about getting the team together, it was reminding me of a situation where a peer was removed.
Yes.
For something that happened. I remember knowing that, and their team was super tight, super tight. And they had a bit of an awareness, but not total awareness. But they were quite a high profile team within the organization at the time. And I was aware of it because I'd been pulled into it. And we looked at them and went, someone's going to have to run it. And I remember saying, I took over part-time for a while because I thought I knew if we put somebody new in then, they would not accept it. Whereas the plus point was most people knew me and I was an easier move.
Yes.
Because the relationships were there in a very different way. You know, it wasn't a role I was normally in, but there was this piece of actually, we're going to have to treat them really gently for a little while because they are really going to feel this because they idolized this person. Yes. And it was horrible and sad, but actually, they came through relatively well, but it was because there was knowledge. If I put somebody new in, we'd never have been able to tell them what happened.
So I think, yes, what you're saying is important. If you have the opportunity to use someone, whether it's just on an interim basis, to actually help that team start to kind of work through this, you're in a better position of bringing someone else new in. Because what we think we recognise is the fact that actually, and one of my friends uses this word quite a bit, the team are very fragile. And it's what you do with that fragility that's important here. And that can either fragile completely smash the jar, or the fragile can be, well, I can't remember the Japanese phrase, it starts to bring that team back together a little bit if we do it properly.
Yeah. And that's not to say the hand grenade isn't needed sometimes. I think especially if you're in a storming situation where you've got a team who are really fighting each other. I mean, not out and out arguments, because that never happens. God, if it did, life would be so much easier. In some ways, I'd rather a bit of open conflict. But when you've got a team in conflict, sometimes there is that need to throw the hand grenade in and make people face it. But equally, when you've got a team who are fragile, that has to be dealt with very sensitively, because they're feeling exposed, and the person, the amount of interpersonal risk they're willing to take is a lot lower. And often we talk about psychological safety a lot with teams, and that means, is it, am I safe to be able to speak up without fear of any comeback? So whether that's about my view, my feeling that I'm not sure what I'm doing, that I need to learn, that I've made a mistake, all of that is it safe in this team to say stuff? And yeah. When a team's had someone ripped out, especially if it's at a senior organizational level, it doesn't feel safe anymore. And that's why they're fragile, because they're exposed. And the fear is always, when's it me?
Yes.
And, you know, you get little cliques forming because there's a protectionism.
Yes.
It's how can we keep each other safe? And I've absolutely seen that happen when we've lost, you know, working in PLCs, if your share price isn't right, you get a new chief exec, it's great. It's not, it's bloody awful, but that's the reality of it.
Yeah, I think it's recognising, you know, going back to this word fragile, I think an awful lot of people don't recognise, they assume the team is resilient, they're robust, but they don't necessarily recognise the fragility that that team currently has. That might be fragility for, you know, a couple of weeks or a couple of months or whatever in that respect. But so creating the forum when something like that happens, where people can start to talk more freely, etc., and where you as a leader say, look, kind of, you know, I'm affected by this as well, and this is how I'm feeling, and that can start to enable the discussions and the free flow and the expressions of whatever to come out. And people need to be allowed to go through that, because if they don't, they'll start to internalize it. And that internalizing then might start to turn into bitterness, resentment, whatever else in that way. So we need to, however the forum's done, doesn't matter, but it's a social, there's a few beers and a few wines, or whether it's a sit down in a workshop and doing something, it doesn't matter. Whether it's an external facilitator because they've got no baggage, so they can ask those challenging questions a little bit. And what's the phrase used? Poke the bear a little bit. We can do that because they need to be taken there. They need to be allowed that space.
Yeah. And often that external can be really useful because they hold the safety. They're not coming in with an agenda. And actually people feel more comfortable talking to somebody who isn't in the business. Because they know there's not going to be a kickback. So it seems a bit odd sometimes to bring somebody in who isn't there. But the reality is they've probably got the skill to sit with that uncomfortableness, because they have no, they've got no skin in the game. So therefore, you know, it doesn't affect them. They're going to walk away with, it's not that they're not going to have empathy, but they're not, there's no issue that's going to pull them into it.
No. And I think, as we both know, those type of external people have a lot more tools and experience in their kit bag to pull out the right tool for the right reason, the right time with the right person. And a lot of managers, they simply, in those respects, they simply don't have that.
Yeah. And it's that experience of facilitating and sitting with that stuckness and going, actually, do you know what? It's going to be really difficult to have a conversation about, but we're going to sit here till we do.
Yeah. And sometimes
it's got to be got through.
As you say, throwing that hand grenade in, because we need to actually break this up to rebuild it.
Yeah. And that doesn't mean as a team leader, you can't run a session like
no,
that, but potentially do it with somebody else. So I remember internally as a team leader having to do that with a team where they were really in conflict, but I took in my training manager and went, I may have to leave the room at some point. You may need to hold this because they may not do it with me in, because I might be too close to it. So I think always having, if you're an internal person, having a buddy is super safe, because if you've poked the bear too much, you can walk out the room and then get annoyed at you, and there's still somebody to run it.
Yes. And I think that external facilitation also is not just about the team, but actually we both know that that role of that leader is so critical. So that leader sometimes needs to have feedback and observation shared, experience shared, or prodded, or actually challenged, if you like. Because they very much are that kind of that linchpin in terms of breaking the team or holding the team together.
And also sometimes they need to be part of the discussion, and it's very difficult. No matter how experienced a facilitator you are, you cannot be part of the discussion and run it. Doesn't work. You do both jobs badly. So actually, if you need to be in there, having that external so you can be part of the team makes such a difference. So I'm conscious we've talked through lots of different aspects here, and we've touched on team members, we've touched on team leaders, we've touched on voluntary versus enforced change. But there's probably one final bit that I want to think about around teams is where that there's an enforced change around market conditions or mandate, where it's not actually team members, it's what they're requiring to do and how that then affects team. What have you seen coming up where that's been the case? And COVID, in some ways, COVID was one of those great examples of that.
Yeah,
how different teams responded to it in different ways.
How different teams responded and how it forced people to start to think differently over a short period of time to bring change about for themselves. Whether that's personal change, now working from home, etc. You know, that very much is a change of mandates. You know, some organizations spent 10, 15 years trying to kind of get that culture to exist. And actually COVID almost changed it overnight in that respect. So when there's a mandate change or a significant external change, I have to think about, I think, two things. Is that change, is it going to cause a revolution that needs to happen? In which case that requires a certain skill set, mindset, approach to it. Or is it an evolutionary change, which we can actually manage a lot better in-house in that way? And I think people, an awful lot of change in this particular, is why we need to change. And people need to understand that. They understand it. Yeah, we've been done to here, but why are we doing it? Why do we need to change here? Right, now I understand it. Again, I may not agree with it, but I'm happy to start to work with it in that respect. I think the impact of externals, you know, again, external change, again, is very much dependent upon what people's experiences of change. You know, there's an argument to say that, you know, that kind of the newer generations, perhaps because change happened more frequently, internal or external, they're a little bit more resilient to it. But if you examine it, actually, now we've got five generations in the workplace. Somewhere change, I have this kind of this phrase, kind of change used to happen occasionally, there'll be change, a period of stability and change again, etc. But now I call it, I've read somewhere, perpetual white waters of change.
I love that.
Perpetual white waters of change. It's ever present. And if you've got five generations, how to manage that in an organization, especially when change being done to you, is really, really difficult, especially some of the older generations, because they're not used to it.
Yeah. And I disagree a little bit on whether or not there's a difference in generational piece. Not that there is a difference. I disagree whether the people who are new into the workplace are more resilient, because I'm not sure they are. And where this comes from is I've worked with a few organizations where they've gone through restructures recently, in the last sort of 12 months or so, where market conditions have changed. And they've had team members who have been under 30 at the start of their career. And they've never known the business go through a restructure, because the last time that industry went through it was in 08, and they weren't working. And actually, the people who'd been through it before were like, all right, here we go again. And they were all right. Mm. But the people who weren't just didn't, they had no anchor. And that was a really interesting, because we were doing change workshops just to get the managers to think about how to deal with it. And it was really interesting that that was where the challenge was coming from.
I think when there's this external change going on, especially it's forced change, you know, organizations now are comprised of, and teams are comprised of, as I alluded to earlier, a lot more experts in their field rather than generalists. So I think there's a huge opportunity / necessity when this exchange happens, is sitting down with my team of experts, because I've recruited experts, whether managers and leaders think about it or not, I set out to recruit a particular person, set behaviors, skill sets. Is how do I then say, okay, this change is happening to us, it's been done to, okay, guys, what do we do here? How do we approach this? And utilizing that internal expertise to come up with a game plan for it a little bit. So you learn to respond to it rather than have to react to it. I think if you react to it, that's when the wheels start to come off a little bit, rather than actually sitting down. What's changed happening? How's it going to affect us? Where's it going to affect us? What do we need to think about? And responding to it accordingly.
Yeah. So in all those instances where we're talking about it, it's where people, the change is enforced, but people have gone along with it. The organization's gone along with it. I think there's also some of the stuff, and we definitely saw this through COVID, and I think there's still a degree of it. You know, the people are going, we must be back to the office. Everyone's back. We're not doing this hybrid working thing. Is where organizations are so invested in how they've always worked that they don't want to change their model because it seems like too big an ask, or they're still trying. There's a bit of a head in sand, a bit of an ostrich moment going on, where they're looking at all this newness that's coming on, you know, and AI is the classic piece about which people are having this massive panic over. Instead of sensibly stepping back and going, how can I adopt this? Where can it help me? There's this fear of, no, we must protect against it. It's the worst thing ever. And I think what you then see is this lethargy in organizations where teams, especially senior teams, are often terrified of starting something because they don't have all the answers and they don't know where it's going to go.
Yes.
You know, so there's this freeze that happens because I can't predict what this is. So instead of going, actually, we're going to move forward and it's going to be iterative. And we're, you know, we sort of know what the end vision is, but we're not sure how we're going to get there, but we'll check in stages and working in like real agile sprint methodology. They just don't do it. And if you look at my old profession of retail, you know, that's why Debenhams, Topshop, all these massive organizations who were huge failed. So they didn't change their business model.
Yes, and coming back to COVID here, you know the example I'm going to talk about. During COVID, an awful lot of organisations said, well, let's wait and see what happens, and then we'll make a decision. Let's wait and see. Now, 6 months later, they're still waiting to see what's happened. Actually, this isn't ending. And, you know, you and I are great kind of advocates of Patrick Lencioni and his podcast. And one of his podcasts is entitled Plant Your Freaking Tree. Excuse the language. And his argument is, look, kind of, in the COVID example, it's a classic one. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know. The world's changing around you quite quickly. Now, rather than wait and see what happens, actually, let's walk 20 meters and plant that tree. Let's work towards that point and learn about it and be agile and adapt accordingly. And when we get to that tree, or if that tree then has to move, we'll move it another 20 meters and we'll work to that point. So we'll eventually get to where we need to go, even though we don't know necessarily where we need to go at this moment in time. But we'll get there. If we have to adapt and move the tree left or right, then so be it, we'll do it. But it's that kind of mindset which doesn't enable this responsiveness rather than a reaction to something. And by doing that, at least you'll give your team focus, direction, clarity, communication, understanding and reasoning, and they're more likely to get it and be party to it and work with you and support you and enable you to achieve that rather than actually, where are we going? What is the future? Well, other teams are doing stuff. Why aren't we doing stuff, etc.? Which has a huge impact upon culture, performance, etc.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really valid point, especially around giving the team an anchor. So I know I've seen this in quite a few businesses, especially also when I've gone as a facilitator and they've gone, oh, we've got a new chief exec, or we're waiting for the strategy, or we don't know what's happening with our line manager and whether we're moving forward. And we can't set goals. Well, you can. What do you mean we can? I said, so is what you're doing going to change dramatically in the next 3 months? No. Fine. Set the goals and your operational plan for 3 months. And then in 2 months' time, review it. If nothing's changed, and then do it for another 3 months and just shorten your time scale. Yes. And if 3 months is too long, just do a month. And then do another month. Because what this gives then is people this focus that they can get on with stuff. And it's exactly what you meant about the tree and then moving it out if you need to. It's just shorten the timescales. If you have no view of what's happening, don't plan for a year or 2 years or 3 years. Plan for a shorter time period. And that is the heart of iterative.
Yeah, and what it does at the same time, and people aren't even aware of it, it starts to build this resilience to change. Because they're doing it incrementally, if you like. You know, a little bit of change, got to this goal, etc. Like, we need to adapt and flex and develop new behaviors or habits, etc. Fine, then we do it again. We have to unlearn and relearn processes. So yeah, so, and I think organizations as well and leaders, you mentioned here, kind of, well, we don't know this, we don't have that information. But there's also a reframe of the mindset. What do we know? What's that tell us? And therefore, what can we do with that information?
And if we don't know, who in our business might know?
Absolutely.
That we need to listen to? And if we don't know in our business, who externally can we listen to? Because the real challenge is, especially if we only ever recruit people from within our industry, is we get stuck in this massive echo chamber. When somebody out there has the answers, we just aren't asking the right people.
Yeah, and rather than working hard about it, it's kind of work a bit smarter. Look, if something happens in the external markets, the chances are it's going to happen to other organisations as well. So what are they doing? How are they approaching it? What's their mindset to this, if you like? They're in exactly the same situation. They're going to have to make decisions as well. Okay, we might be a little bit behind the curve, but how do we, not about becoming them, but how do we emulate some of the things that they're doing for us and adapt it to our needs?
So working from a true R&D approach, not research and development, rob and duplicate.
Absolutely.
Don't reinvent the wheel. If someone's done it, just credit them and crack on.
This is very little new things, if you like. Even if you look like AI, which was, you know, back in the early 2000s was the thing, that goes back to Aristotle. So there's nothing new here.
No, she's got a different frock on.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so we've rattled around different aspects of change with teams today, from members to leaders to the impact of organizational change to mandated change versus voluntary and how that affects. If we've got people listening who are either in a team or leading a team or can influence how the team is led, what would your advice be to them for some of the things they can do to deal with the constant shifts, which is what we have highlighted, that are going to be happening in their teams?
Yeah. And you know, I've touched on a few already, but I think the first thing is just stop. Don't dive in, just stop. Take a step back, think, process what's happening, and make some informed decisions, if you like. Now, don't dive in. Take time to observe. Be more systemic in your thinking, not just about what's happening to my team, but how is it happening, impacting upon the other teams, departments, etc. What do they do? What do we need to learn? And so wherever possible, utilize your team. Utilize their creativity, their ideas, their experiences. Now, so many of the answers you need lie within your team. You just need to tap into it. Now, think about the roles and responsibilities and how they perhaps need to adapt and change. Create a sense of purpose for your team. You know, how do I develop engagement through this transition process? You know, how do I ensure that the team know the why of this change, why we're doing it? Stephen Covey said the three most important things in a business are communication, communication, communication. And here's a classic example. In change, be communicating all the time, different methods, reinforcement, etc. Because if you don't, that's where people start to fill the gaps with their own insights. I think another key thing is, don't just think about team, think about all the stakeholders who are engaged in your team, and have a stakeholder analysis with your team. What does it mean for the stakeholders? How do we approach them? What's the impact here? How do we communicate? A lot of organizations, when change happens, they do things to teams. They communicate to teams. They set up training for teams, which is not necessarily wrong. But think about it, reframe it differently in terms of actually how do we workshop with teams? How do we communicate with teams? So involving and enabling the teams in that to be the sources of their own growth and change, if you like. I think managers have to adopt a we mindset. Where are we in this? How are we doing? What do we need to do? Does that inclusivity reads the team mentality? You also need to think about your own particular leadership style. You know, if you don't know what it is, do some research, find out what it is, etc. You can just take a base model like situational leadership. What is your leadership style? What is leadership style does your team, do your individuals in that team need at that moment in time? But first and foremost, whenever change is happening, whether it's team, whether it's local or organizational, what's the vision? Where are we going? I want to, if I'm going through this change, I want to know where we're going. I might not necessarily know at this moment how we're getting there, but I want to know where we're going. If I know where we're going, I can start to work out the how for myself or the team a little bit in that respect. But otherwise, how am I going to get there if I don't know where we're going? You know, those are some of the principles, if you like, just to apply to all change, not just organisational external change in that way.
I think listening to all those great points you pulled out, there's a theme that comes out across all of them. And the fact that this is a series of conversations.
Yes.
You know, it's got nothing to do with the best piece of communication, whether it's on the intranet, whether we've put it onto Yammer, or whether we've sent out a really nice infogram and told people about it. I mean, they're useful, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But actually, this is about a series of intentional conversations, because the more we can build those conversations and the more we can get people open to having conversations with us, the easier it is to move things through. You know, I think I have a strong belief is as a leader of a team, your ultimate role is, yes, you need to get the team to where they need to be and achieve the results you need to achieve. But at the end of the day, they need to be happy to tell you when things are going well, and they need to be equally happy to tell you when things are going wrong, and that they can pick the phone up and tell you anything and you deal with it. But that conversation piece is absolutely crucial.
Yeah, and what enables that conversational piece? Well, it's not you being an organization leader. It's about you as a leader showing your humanness. You know, that you're in this with them. If you're like, you're involved in this, you're equally affected as well. How are you thinking and feeling in this? You know, that honesty, wherever it is possible, that transparency, wherever possible, is tantamount in this. It's most important in this. But leaders have to be human through this transitioning people through the change that's happening to them.
Lovely. And I think there we leave it. So hopefully that's given people some insight and some ideas about either what they're seeing happening in their business or what they might come across as they go through, and some real tips and hints to take through. So thank you for joining me in that conversation.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for listening to The Being Leader.